This has been really quite an eventful week, but what I wanted to speak about, I think we should probably kick off with the Nasdaq, because it has been up on consecutive days, and what it is now doing is testing that low that we saw in June, which was a lower rally high. We also had a lower reaction low within the context of what was a reactionary phase. So we're now at a critical juncture. The odds are increasing, however, that it is going to be able to sustain a move up and out of this range. And part of the reason for that is because stock markets are increasingly breaking on the upside. And that is why the news flow this week has been so important. Because when we look at what has been happening, Janet Yellen was speaking this week and was making the point really quite clear that the Fed is going to be cautious, that they want to try and start reducing the size of their balance sheet. But the only other place that has tried to do that was the Eurozone. They took €1 trillion out of circulation, and that had a sharply deflationary impact. So therefore, and the Fed has got to be cognizant of that fact, because it's not exactly, this isn't ancient history. It happened only a few years ago. So they either are enormously hubristic and think that they can do a better job than the EU did, or they're going to be very cautious. And that is why the stock market is beginning to rally, because they also want to raise interest rates, but it is almost beyond comprehension how they could possibly think that they can raise interest rates and shrink the balance sheet at the same time. And therefore, we've had a few interest rate hikes already, and the potential now is that the pace with which they're going to be raising rates in future is going to be slower, and that they are going to be very cautious indeed about how quickly they shrink the size of the balance sheet, and indeed to what extent they do that. The ECB took out €1 trillion. That doesn't mean that the Fed has to do the same, and they may conclude that only a modest shrinking of the balance sheet is enough to satisfy their curiosity as to whether it is even possible. The fact today that CPI inflation came out pretty much flat, then that also questions one of the key pieces or the key quotes from some of the Fed's most recent prognostications. And it was that the factors that were contributing to low inflation over the last 4 and 5 months were transitory. Well, they're still transitory if that's the case, or they haven't really moved out of the calculation just yet based on today's figures. And that represents an additional headwind to them raising rates or beginning to shrink the size of the balance sheet in the near term. Considering that the basis of their figures is that what they're making all of their decisions on, they don't have a great deal of rationale based on what they have been basing their policy on for much of the last few years. There is an additional way of arguing this, though, and it is a big point that perhaps the reason that we don't have inflation is because of the unintended consequences of financial engineering. If we think about what it is that, I mean, this is not the first time in history that we've had a lot of share buybacks. In fact, there were plenty of share buybacks ahead of 2007 as well. When we have relatively low interest rates, then corporate finance, corporate treasuries, what they do is they look at the company's balance sheet and they decide how they're going to deploy their capital. And when interest rates are very low and the cost of equity is quite high, they decide to buy back their shares. And if they're buying back their shares, then they're eschewing the potential to take the risk on expanding their business or investing in capital investments, in infrastructure, in buildings, or in people. So, and the risk of them, the risk that they have from buying back shares is quite low. That generally speaking, shareholders are happy when they're buying back shares. It helps to boost the share price, or when they increase their dividends, shareholders are happy because they're getting a payout. So that refusal to invest heavily in additional demand drivers, in additional things that could really help to foment inflation could be part of the reason. So therefore, could higher interest rates in and of themselves cause a change to that corporate behavior? That's an awfully large question. It's a very and it's something that there's only one way to find out, and it is that if interest rates rise, does inflation follow as a part of that? That the when you think about the weighted average cost of capital, and this is a rather interesting function. And if we take a company like IBM, which has been buying back shares for what feels like forever, and we look at their weighted average cost of capital, then the weight of their equity is about 79%. So you multiply that by the cost, and you come out with about 7.5%. Whereas their debt costs nothing; it's less than half of 1%. So therefore, they can issue debt and buy back equity for the foreseeable future. Now, the dividend on that equity is about 3.89%. So then, if we look at their funding, and we should really look at one of their bonds for that. Well, then we can look at what do their bonds cost, because when it comes down to it, the vast majority, we look at their most liquid bond, which is the 2025 7%, and that means they're paying a 7% coupon, and the yield on that coupon right now is around 2.97%. So the equity yields more than the bonds, which is really how it should be. But they're paying a 7% coupon on those bonds, but their cost of equity is 8%. Now, if interest rates rise, then they would have to pay more on that debt. And if their interest rates rise higher than 7% and they go up to, say, 9%, well, then the coupon on their debt exceeds the cost of the equity. Then the rationale for issuing debt to buy back equity isn't nonsensical. And then they would have to think about how else are they going to generate shareholder value. And that would represent a cause bellum for going in and thinking about investing in some really big projects to try and reignite growth. So these are very large questions. And when we look at the 10-year bond yield, rather than thinking about whether we are in a bull market or a bear market, or and thinking about what the really seriously long-term factors are, well, if, for example, a major buyback achiever company like IBM, and its coupons are around 7%, and it's A-rated. And then you think that the yield on the 10-year is 2.3%. And if that goes up, for example, another percent, it goes up to say 3%. Well, then the rationale for buybacks is going to be questioned. And that's why when you think about if it goes above, like significantly above 3%, and we get a breakout above 3%, which would complete this range in here. What we can certainly see is that in the context of this very lengthy bull market in bonds and bear market in yields, that there have been significant ranges, and that these ranges have been one below another. And so far, this range has dipped into the previous range, but other ranges have also dipped into the previous ranges, so that's not particularly an inconsistency, but the long-term progression of lower rally highs has been sustained. That means that in order to truly question the integrity of this downtrend, it is going to have to at least sustain a move above 3%, and most particularly above 4%. By the time it gets to 4%, we will be already well in the stages of a bear market in bonds, but it is a much bigger question than that, because that will really then begin to also shake the resolve of the corporate sector. I remember it was probably back in 2012. I had a meeting with somebody at the the corporate treasury of Qualcomm. And generally speaking, when you talk to these kinds of people, you don't really learn anything by asking them about their own company, but you learn a lot by asking them about their competitors. And one of the things that he said in passing was that, if my memory serves me correctly, it was around once a quarter that all the corporate treasurers of the NASDAQ 100 companies get together for a meeting. And that's why. And then at that point, they start to talk about what they're doing with their treasury departments and how best to manage the money that they have. So that also helps to explain why they all have almost exactly the same corporate treasury policy, that they've been issuing debt and buying back equity. And if interest rates go up, then that also suggests that they will change their minds en masse, that it won't be one company that decides that the issuing debt and buyback equity strategy no longer works, but rather that it is something that they really have to begin to question. And potentially that is then when we start to get inflation starting to rise again. So, and again, that is would be the kind of inflation that central banks measure. I can't stress that point enough because it's not as if we haven't had inflation. It's just that they don't measure it that way. The fact that that wages have been pretty much stagnant, but that the cost of education, healthcare, and the kinds of things that people actually spend their money on have been increasing and increasing in a really rather dynamic way. All of those factors represent inflation. But again, that really doesn't matter if central banks don't care. So I think that this is a rather interesting juncture, and exactly what happens in terms of the central bank actions is going to have a profound effect. Because if the central bank does in fact raise rates further, it would suggest that they have changed tack, that they have decided that the series of policies that they have initiated over the last decade have not delivered the growth that they want, and they have most particularly have not delivered the inflation that they want. Now, we can think about some of the reasons why that might be the case, and certainly technology is inherently deflationary. The fact that the economies of the major OECD countries are moving increasingly towards services rather than manufacturing stuff. That also upsets the way that they measure productivity. The fact that you can buy something on Amazon now, it is picked off a shelf by a robot, it is put in a box and taped over, probably by a person, and shipped out and delivered. Then the number of steps, the disintermediation of that entire process means that the number of people that are involved in the servicing of the consumer has decreased considerably. The fact that the major factories are automating means that the number of people involved in the manufacturing process is also decreasing. So, therefore, if you are still talking about just one item and you're only talking about the number of people manufacturing it and transporting it, then it's very hard to measure that, especially when it's happening across countries. And therefore, I think that it's no longer even particularly accurate when you talk about productivity figures, that the economy has translated into a service-oriented economy. The fact that you are now getting a larger number of companies are moving towards a subscription model, which creates more utility-type cash flows. But that also generates higher valuations because if you have much more reliable cash flows, it's e much easier to model them, and therefore the fundamental analysis will allow a greater valuation to be put on those earnings. So when we look at, for example, the NASDAQ, this is a we're at, I think, a critical juncture right now. The index posted a somewhat larger reaction. In fact, the size of this reaction is quite similar to the one that we saw back in 2016. So this is still a reasonably consistent advance. And It was up in a robust manner this week. It is testing the progression of lower rally highs. It was the index that was most overextended on the upside when it had that big downward dynamic at the beginning of June. And so far, this has been a relatively orderly consolidation, quite similar to the size of the one we saw at the end of last year. If it sustains a move up and out of this range next week, then we would have to conclude we're back in a demand-dominated environment. There is increasing evidence that that might indeed be the case, with the S&P 500 breaking on the upside in here today. So that is now trading at a new recovery high. Now, a consistent trend is a trend in motion. And a trend in motion means that the rhythm of the market persists. As long as the rhythm of the market is continuing to flow, that if it is breaking out and ranging, breaking out and ranging, breaking out and then ranging, and that one range is above another, and you're not getting failed upside breaks, well, then you can conclude that you're still in a demand-dominated environment and that nothing has happened to challenge the complacency of the bulls. It is when you start to get failed upside breaks and the rhythm of the market is questioned, similar to what we saw back in 2015 when we had those big stabs to the downside. That really did question the integrity of the bull market. So now we're in a rather charmed environment where the kind of inflation that central banks measure is coming in below par. That economic growth is not just picking up in the US, it is picking up in Europe, it is picking up in Asia, and that we're seeing an increasing number of markets breaking out to new high ground. And it is also worth highlighting that the Dow Jones is at a new high, the transportation index is at a new high, and the Russell 2000 did not quite make a new high in here today, but sorry, that is not it. That is something else. I'm not typing very well. The Russell 2000's RTY, not TRY, is not at, quite at a new high today, but it is not far off it either. So that also then has to be translated into what's happening elsewhere. And if we start off in Asia, the Taiwanese market has cleared the 10,000 level for the first time since 1991. The fact that Taiwan was the one of the first destinations for Japanese offshoring, and those two nations still have really quite close economic ties. I think that it is rather interesting that Japan is now trading around that 20,000 level, and I think that there is a reasonable argument that the Taiwanese market is leading it higher. It has been 19, it's it was 1992 the last time that the Nikkei was trading in a meaningful manner above the 20,000 level. And if it can clear at this level and reassert on the upside, well, then I think we have an argument that we are back in not just a short-term demand-dominated environment, but potentially even medium or long-term. Then the Korean market has also broken on the upside, and it is rallying from these levels, and that this is really quite an impressive advance. And it is this is I think a very benign environment. The Indonesian market, which ranged for a pretty significant period, has also broken on the upside. The Filipino market has been testing the upper side of what is a 2-year range, and it has paused in this area. The Thai market, and it has been hasn't been doing much for what feels like a fair amount of time, but this is a very orderly consolidation below that psychological 1600 level. So we are in there is the potential here that it isn't just some, but there is an increasing number of markets that will be able to sustain moves on the upside. And let's not forget about Europe. The Euro stocks in Europe, excuse me, Europe stocks index has bounced this week from the region of the trend mean. Europe is increasingly on the front foot. It went through really quite a difficult period at the beginning of the year where everyone was worried about what was going to happen with Brexit and the French election and the Dutch election. And I think Brexit has had a coalescing effect on some of those European countries. The fact that they have fudged again, the banking regulations to allow bailouts of the Italian banks that they've very neatly been able to fold some of the Spanish banks. So what they are moving increasingly towards is a United States of Europe. I think that it is entirely rational for some countries to decide that that is not what they want, and that is the I think that is the sovereign right of any nation to decide that they would much prefer to go it alone. And this is rather interesting too, because the Euro stocks index, which is just the European indices, has massively underperformed. And it does have, certainly it does have potential for catch up. What is interesting is that the constituents of the FTSE are in the Europe stocks index, and so are the Swiss and the Norwegian, Swedish and Danish markets. But the FTSE is leading on the upside. It has broken up out of what was a really quite lengthy range. It was helped certainly by the weakness of the pound. But the fact that it has exhibited relative strength again, that it is now back in a demand-dominated environment, then we're not just seeing Asian markets breaking on the upside. We're not just seeing US markets breaking on the upside. We're also seeing European markets breaking on the upside. So far, those markets have been either that markets like the UK or Germany, which was among the greatest beneficiaries of the Eurozone. But then also perhaps look at France, because France is pretty much right there in the middle between the countries that have benefited somewhat but not particularly from the Eurozone. And that CAC 40 index is pretty similar to the Euro stocks. So it does look like it is on a recovery trajectory. And that would suggest that we are back in a period of synchronized global economic expansion. And that's something that is reflected in this additional interest that people have in stocks. Now, when we think about it from that perspective, and taking into account everything that I've already said about the bond markets, we're in a really quite a charmed environment right now, because if central banks are going to be at least cautious in raising interest rates, and economic growth is coming in the positive territory, and the kind of inflation that they measure is pretty muted, well then that is almost a Goldilocks scenario for equities. And if we begin to even think about where are we in terms of the psychological perception stages of major bull and bear markets, well, we're not in disbelief. That was back in 2008, 9, and even 10, where people really didn't believe that there was any possibility that we were going to have a bull market. The market has been going up for a fair while already, and valuations have gone up again. So I think we are certainly in acceptance. If an increasing number of markets are breaking on the upside, there is this is the big question, is whether we are now leaving acceptance and moving into the euphoria stage. That investors begin to conclude that that inflation is not going back up, that interest rates are going to remain lower for longer, and that the only way to make money is to take on the additional risk of buying equities, and that that will be self-reinforcing if we're seeing an increasing number of markets breaking on the upside. The Nifty index in India is also testing that big psychological 10,000 level, and it was up in a robust manner in here this week. So, we are seeing just one market after another that is doing better. So, and I want to be even-handed. So, I think we do have to look at China. But the H share index in Hong Kong has been firming from the 10,000 level, and this is a rhythmic advance as well. You've got a staircase step sequence uptrend, and it is rallying from the lower side. Obviously, it is not at new highs. I think China is the one country that has been tightening, and this is a, I think, a rather fraught political period where there are a substantial number of seats in the Politburo need to be replaced. And of the 7-member standing committee, there are only going to be two that aren't going to be replaced later this year. So that is something that is going to represent an a source of uncertainty for China, and I really don't anticipate that the mainland market is going to do very much of anything ahead of that party congress in September or October. What is interesting, though, is that when we are looking at this environment and thinking about that, if we are in fact coming towards the end of the acceptance stage and potentially moving into the euphoria stage, where valuations don't just get fully valued, but that they get overvalued, then what are the types of sectors that are likely to do best? Well, we have had something of a mean reversion in some of the really high momentum shares. So, for example, Tesla came back almost $100 and bounced in here today from the region of the trend mean. So it has come back from a high of 386 to 300, which is a fairly substantial move, and came back to test the upper side of the underlying range. And this is one of the most highly levered companies. And Amazon is another. But this remains one of the most consistent trends out there. And the fact that the reaction, such as it has been around this 1,000 level, has been really very orderly. The fact that it continues to get up to that level and pull back, and get up to that level and pull back, and now it's back at that level again, that this would appear to be not so much top formation development, but that it is a consolidation in the region of a big psychological level. And Google is not nearly as leveraged as Amazon, but it has also paused in the region of 1,000. It went through a partial pullback and consolidation. And what we can also see with Amazon is that it got up to 1,000 and it came back to about 915. And if we go back and look at its history, then reactions of $100 are not so much the exception but the rule. And it has just had another one. Then this also remains really quite a consistent advance. And every time it gets overextended relative to the trend mean, it pulls back towards it. This is almost one of the. It's a great example of the individual consistency of a trend, and as long as it is doing that, then there is no reason to question the upward bias. But then, if we are in the latter stages of a bull market, where we're only beginning to enter the potentially enter the acceleration phase, then what are the things that should do well? Well, they should be cyclical shares. And the banking sector fits really quite neatly into that sector. So the banks were a little bit softer in here, but the most important thing they did was break up and out of that range back in just following the presidential election. And as long as they are trading above the trend mean, we can give the benefit of doubt to the upside. Then you have the mining sector. They are inherently leveraged to global economic growth, and the FTSE 350 mining index, which is representative of the major miners, has broken on the upside in here. It really quite firmly bouncing from the region of the trend mean. It's a pretty similar story for the resources sector in Australia, which has also bounced from the region of the trend mean and is actually pressuring now that progression of lower rally highs from the beginning of this year. So that's also an additional area. Now, biotechnology is representative of really high growth technology sectors, and it broke emphatically higher 2 weeks ago. And so far, the reaction has consolidation has been pretty narrow. I think that the potential for biotech to really start to move on the upside again, following what was a really quite abrupt pullback in 2015 and a fairly lengthy range all of last year, it is looking increasingly likely that biotech is going to be among the better performers over the not just the short term but the medium term, as we move into what is a really quite a benign environment. The fact that so many of these emerging markets are really just beginning to get out of the blocks. And I often hesitate to look at emerging market ETFs because they are so heavily weighted by China. And China is the market that is perhaps least likely to benefit in the short term, that it really does have so much political uncertainty attached to it that it is going to be other markets do better. But I wanted to highlight this ETF because it's tracking the MSCI Emerging Markets Index, and it has been marching higher since the beginning of the year. It was up in a robust manner this week, and it is coming back up towards this $45 area, which has been an area of resistance since 2012. And if it clears that, well, then that is going to be, I think, a more convincing argument that we are back in a demand-dominated environment for the emerging markets. And considering that generally they're higher beta, if they are moving up and out of long-term ranges, then they have the potential to outperform by a fairly considerable margin. And I think it is also worth looking at some of these currencies because the Asia Dollar Index, which had trended lower from 2011 and really accelerated lower into the lows last year, has held a progression of higher reaction lows all year and bounced this week from the region of the trend mean. So that would suggest that money is flowing into some of these Asian markets. And this is the Latin America Dollar Index. And despite the fact that you have these big questions about what's going to happen in Brazil and the weakness of the peso after the Trump election, what in fact has happened is that the Latin American Dollar Index trended lower from 2011 and stopped going down at the beginning of 2016 and has been forming a base since. So, since the Brazilian real and the Mexican peso constitute the vast majority of the weighting of this index, the real has been firming up this week, and the Mexican peso is hit an accelerated low back at the beginning of this year, and it has been strengthening all year. And that's despite the fact that energy prices have been really quite volatile. It would suggest that this is an environment where investors are looking at the performance of the US and certainly benefiting from that, but that they are also open to the potential that we are going to have additional upside from emerging markets and from a broader basket of indices that are helping to support this bull market. That it is looking increasingly likely that the reversionary process that started in May is coming to a conclusion. And that's important because then we are potentially now entering the acceleration phase. And of course, the market is completely addicted to liquidity. But if central banks are not raising rates in an aggressive manner, if inflation is not taking off, well, then that is a cause for additional leverage for investors, that they will look on this market and say, well, if and we have actually seen that an increasing number of these hedge funds, I mean, even Ray Dalio saying, oh, well, the music, we're dancing, we're still dancing, but just a little bit closer to the exit, to quoting Chuck Prince from Citigroup ahead of the financial crisis, that they're cognizant of what the risks are, but they don't see any great deal of evidence just yet that it is over. And that is also characteristic of the fact that we're probably moving into a more accelerated phase. And I think that it is worth looking at some of the things that people consider to be safe havens. Gold prices were around 1228 today, and finally something in the order of a candle that stands out on the chart. I hesitate to call it an upper dynamic, but it has bounced at least from that $1,200 area. If we look at this on the weekly chart, the most important thing that's happened is that it had that massive reaction against the prevailing downtrend in 2016. And subsequently, we have been confined to this volatile ranging phase. Could still potentially be a type 2 bottom with right-hand extension. But if that is indeed the case, then the 1100 area will need to hold. And if short-term upward, or I guess if the bulls are to have their way, then the $1,200 level will need to hold. Upside follow through next week would at least break the downward bias over the last 6 weeks. Silver prices experienced a flash crash last Friday and have bounced over the balance of this week and are pushing the $16 area right now. And around that $15 area, and perhaps more down to $14, has represented an area of support over much of the last almost 3 years. So this is a natural area where we might anticipate that there is a bounce occurring. Platinum prices have held the $900 area, and we're up about $16 in here today. So we're starting to get at least some evidence of demand returning to dominance around this $900 area. Palladium, which has been the clear outperformer, is up to 857. So that difference between platinum and palladium hasn't been this tight, and indeed hasn't reversed in an awfully long time. And it would represent a psychological Rubicon in terms of the reaction of some of the catalytic converter manufacturers in terms of which metal they're willing to use. One of the markets that has been receiving incredible attention this year is Bitcoin, and it was down over $100 today. That was a major peak around 3,000. And one of the points that I've highlighted on a number of occasions is that it was the Chinese consumer was one of the biggest buyers of Bitcoin, and primarily as a vehicle for trying to get their money out of China as a way of protecting themselves from the devaluation of the currency. But with the strengthening of the renminbi, then that has removed part of the reason or the urgency for getting their money out of China, and that is now being felt by Bitcoin. So there is the potential that we're going to see Bitcoin prices coming down from here, and that could potentially set us up for the next entry point. But in the meantime, it looks like a market that is really quite risky. When we think about the currency markets, the pound really stood out this week. And part of the reason for that is because if the UK is going to prosper in an environment where it is outside the EU, then it has to control its fiscal spending. The most important thing when it is outside the EU is going to be its success at attracting foreign direct investment. It's already got the advertising campaign underway, but what it needs to do is to demonstrate that it can keep its fiscal house in order so that the currency is reasonably stable. In order, just like emerging markets, foreign investors tend to flock to emerging markets when they have the potential for currency market, capital market, and yield. And that's one of the reasons that India is doing so well recently, because inflation is way below what the RBI's target is. There's the potential for interest rate cuts, and that should reignite growth. Well, the UK has already had the interest rate cuts. It's already had the boost from that low currency, and now inflation is picking up. So they're going to have to demonstrate that they can try to control inflation, at least in line with the growth of the economy, in order to really begin to attract that foreign direct investment, which the country needs. And that is the reason that people are betting that the pound is going to go up. The pound moved to a new recovery high today, and closed out the day at 130.98. This chart pattern, where you had this 3 year downtrend, and then it stopped at the end of last year, and then broke upwards, and you have this first step above that little base. As long as it is holding the region of the moving average, as long as it is sustaining this breakout, we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And the pound was particularly volatile this week against the euro. The euro had broken out in on Tuesday and failed, and now the pound has been stronger for 3 consecutive days and is testing the lower side of the 1 month range. Additional downside next week, or strength in the pound next week, would confirm a failed upside break for the euro, and would really heighten the potential that we're going to go right back down and test the 84 level. There really is the potential here that the UK will be very reticent to raise interest rates, but they're more important, I guess, lifeline in terms of really trying to create a competitive environment for the economy will be to maintain the fiscal front, and that means that interest rate hikes cannot be taken off the table. So that is certainly a point in the pound's favor, but it may act as a headwind for the FTSE in the short term. Well, I think I've covered the majority of points. David has sent me an email that he has asked me to post, so just on his health condition. His recovery is not going as swiftly as he had hoped, so he is going to be taking in some additional time off just for R&R and spending most of it down at his home in Devon. And in the meantime, we will continue to endeavour to provide you with the best possible service we can. And I think with that, I will leave for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.